Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Post-Decision Attorney-Client Privilege Collateral Order Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On December 8, 2009, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Mohawk Industries v. Carpenter. In this case, the court considered whether a party may immediately appeal a discovery order to disclose materials said to be covered by the attorney-client privilege. In a 9-0 decision delivered by Justice Sotomayor, the court held that disclosure orders that are adverse to the attorney-client privilege do not qualify for immediate appeal under the collateral order doctrine. The court reasoned that post-judgment appeals, along with other review mechanisms, were sufficient to protect the rights of litigants. Justice Thomas filed a separate opinion. He concurred in part and concurred in the judgment. To discuss the case, we have University of Illinois College of Law Professor Paul Stanzel. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Stanzel.
This is Professor Paul Stanzel, and today I'll be discussing the Supreme Court's recent decision in Mohawk Industries v. Carpenter. The case resolves a circuit split regarding whether and when litigants that are upset with a trial court's decision to order production of purportedly privileged materials can be appealed during as opposed to after the litigation. The case thus touches on several important issues: the strength of the attorney-client privilege, the role of the appellate courts during and after trial court proceedings, and maybe even the separation of powers between Congress and the courts. The case is also interesting because it is the first Supreme Court opinion authored by Justice Sonia Sotomayor. Over the next few minutes, I'll summarize the facts of the case, discuss the majority opinion and Justice Thomas's concurrence, and offer a few observations about the politics and the broader implications of the decision. There are actually two separate pieces of litigation involved in this case, and the Supreme Court's involvement results from a situation where the two litigations intersected. Norman Carpenter worked for Mohawk. According to Carpenter's federal complaint, he discovered that Mohawk was illegally employing undocumented immigrants. Unbeknownst to Carpenter, Mohawk was already involved in another case involving similar allegations, class action claiming that Mohawk was involved in a conspiracy to drive down employee wages by hiring undocumented workers. According to Carpenter, he complained to Mohawk management about their hiring practices and was directed to meet with Mohawk's outside lawyer. As Carpenter tells the story, that lawyer pressured Carpenter to recant his allegations, and when Carpenter refused, Mohawk fired him. Plaintiffs in the class action soon learned about Carpenter's conversation with Mohawk's lawyer, and they filed a motion seeking an evidentiary hearing to explore Carpenter's allegations. At that hearing, Mohawk described Carpenter's allegations as, quote, pure fantasy, and accused Carpenter of being the wrongdoer. According to Mohawk, Carpenter tried to get Mohawk to hire an undocumented worker in violation of law and company policy. In Mohawk's version of the story, Carpenter's meeting with outside counsel was part of a corporate investigation into Carpenter's wrongdoing, and Carpenter was fired because he tried to get Mohawk to break the law. After that hearing, Carpenter himself sought discovery from Mohawk of all materials relating to his conversation with Mohawk's lawyer. Mohawk opposed the request on attorney-client privilege grounds. The district court concluded that the material was in fact privileged, but that Mohawk had waived the privilege by putting the content and character of Carpenter's interview with outside counsel in play in the class action evidentiary hearing. The district court declined to certify an interlocutory appeal of its waiver decision to the 11th Circuit, but it did stay its decision to allow Mohawk to seek either mandamus or an immediate interlocutory appeal under what is called the collateral order doctrine. Now, the collateral order doctrine establishes a few narrow but very well recognized exceptions to the general rule that no appeal can be taken until judgment is final in a case. Mohawk took advantage of this, pursuing both a mandamus action and a collateral order appeal. The 11th Circuit rejected both. The Supreme Court granted cert to resolve a circuit split over whether disclosure orders adverse to the attorney-client privilege qualify for immediate appeal under the collateral order doctrine. Justice Sotomayor wrote for the court in an opinion joined by everyone except Justice Thomas, who concurred in part, concurred in the judgment, and wrote separately to articulate his philosophical concerns with the collateral order doctrine in general. Justice Sotomayor's concise and workmanlike opinion takes a decidedly pragmatic approach to the question presented. She concludes that, though disclosure decisions adverse to the attorney-client privilege can be a very big deal to litigants, they simply do not, as a categorical matter, present the extraordinary circumstances necessary to invoke an immediate appeal right under the collateral order doctrine. She emphasizes that there are other options available to aggrieved litigants and relies heavily upon the conclusion that the costs associated with allowing interlocutory appeals of this type would significantly outweigh the benefits. Now, the collateral order doctrine dates to the court's 1949 decision in Cohen. And in that case, the court recognized a limited exception to the traditional final judgment rule, under which most trial rulings cannot be appealed until after a final judgment is entered. Under the collateral order doctrine introduced by Cohen, immediate interlocutory appeal is available if, one, the decision in question is, quote, conclusive, two, if the decision resolves important issues that are separate from the merits of the case, and three, if the decision is for some reason, quote, effectively unreviewable, end quote, on appeal from a final judgment. In Mohawk, Sotomayor focuses only on the third prong of the Cohen test, the effectively unreviewable prong, concluding that, as a class, challenges to district court orders to produce allegedly privileged documents can effectively be reviewed after final judgment is entered. Now, the court offers several justifications for this conclusion. It quite correctly emphasizes the efficiency values advanced by the final judgment rule, and it is understandably wary of the time, expense, and potential gamesmanship associated with any expansion of interlocutory appeal rights. The opinion also emphasizes that the collateral order doctrine can be invoked in favor of interlocutory appeal only when adherence to the final judgment rule would, quote, imperil a substantial public interest or, quote, some particular value of a high order. Thus, the inquiry is generalized rather than individualized. A collateral order appeal is to be available only if the entire class of orders in question justifies application of the doctrine. Sotomayor notes that the standard is not perfect. She is willing to suffer imperfect post-judgment remedies if, on balance, the benefits of the final judgment rule outweigh the costs. She also notes that we routinely require litigants to wait until after judgment to vindicate even important rights. The court confidently asserts that effective review of adverse privilege decision is available after final judgment because appellate courts can vacate adverse judgments and remand for new trials, quote, in which the protected materials and its fruit are excluded from evidence. Moreover, the court concludes that retention of the final judgment rule will not significantly chill full disclosure between clients and their attorneys. Now, for that small percentage of cases where stakes are highest, Sotomayor suggests that litigants retain meaningful opportunities to obtain interlocutory or immediate review. She notes that district court's certification of difficult questions does remain available, and that parties that are ordered to disclose may also seek the extraordinary remedy of mandamus against the district judge. Sotomayor suggests that in extreme cases, parties might choose to face sanctions or even contempt charges rather than disclose. And, of course, contempt findings are immediately appealable. Finally, Sotomayor notes that the legislative climate is relatively hostile to judicial expansion of interlocutory appeal rights. She refers to some recent amendments to the Rules Enabling Act and other procedural statutes, all of which emphasize that Congress and the committee rulemaking process are the preferred avenues for further definition of the scope of interlocutory appeal rights. At the end of the day, the Mohawk opinion concludes that the costs of a rule allowing interlocutory appeal of adverse privilege decisions as a matter of right would far exceed the benefits. Sotomayor's opinion is explicitly and really rather unapologetically an exercise in cost-benefit analysis. The only real question is whether the underlying assumptions about the size and shape of those costs and benefits are justified. And Justice Thomas concurred. Now, as he often does, Thomas uses his pen to raise bigger questions about the conceptual and even constitutional validity of the collateral order doctrine itself. While he stops just short of rejecting Cohen outright, Thomas strongly prefers to let Congress and the congressionally crafted committee rulemaking process decide whether to expand federal appellate jurisdiction beyond its current boundaries. Thomas is ostensibly reluctant to overrule Cohen, but his concurrence offers a concise and scathing critique of the slippery slope problems engendered by the doctrine. Thomas points out the absurdities occasioned by the Supreme Court's repeated attempts to define and confine the doctrine, and ultimately concludes that it would be best to retire Cohen's test entirely in favor of congressional determination of any further interlocutory appeal rights. And because neither the existing statutes nor pre-existing decisions under Cohen would authorize interlocutory appeal of adverse privilege decisions, Thomas agrees with the result reached by the majority. And it remains to be seen whether the assumptions undergirding Justice Sotomayor's cost-benefit analysis are reasonable. At first blush, it seems possible that she and at least seven of her eight colleagues are somewhat too sanguine about, among other things, one, the real ability of appellate courts to restore the status quo ante in a post-judgment appeal, and call that the unringing the bell problem. Two, the viability of certification, mandamus, and appeals from contempt findings as meaningful alternatives to interlocutory appeal of right. And three, the cost savings that will result from applying the traditional final judgment rule. To that end, it is interesting and perhaps instructive that Chief Justice Roberts assigned this opinion to Sotomayor. Of all the members of the current court, Justice Sotomayor has by far the most recent and the most extensive real-world experience at the trial level. She spent many years as an in-the-trenches prosecutor and then civil litigator, followed by 6 years on the federal district bench. It is at least possible that Roberts assigned the Mohawk opinion to Sotomayor in part because she is better inoculated against claims of judicial detachment than her colleagues are. All in all, the Mohawk opinion is a solid and eminently defensible piece of work that may nonetheless be wrong.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.